Muddy Knees Media.
Totally Football Show. Today, FA Cup final. Double whammy from Aubameyang while Pulisic does his hammy. And the Blues see the biggest Zuma failure since you on your lockdown quiz. What will the cup win mean for Arteta's Arsenal? Will fears of Oba's departure prove as baseless as the trophy once he was through with it? Also today, we'll be talking about Eddie Howe as he takes a bow and says cheerio to the Cherries. Newcastle, the same old story there. And the biggest game in football, Claxon, as Brentford take on Fulham in the Championship playoffs. All that in the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Listener, it's August the 3rd, and joining us on the Totally Football Show, we've got Michael Cox. Hi, Michael.
Hi, James.
Nice to see you. James Horncastle's with us as well. James.
Good day to you.
And indeed to you, sir. And it's a big hello to Raphael Honigstein.
Hello.
Nice. All right. Big week, this. Big week in football, as 11 months in the season finally gets interesting with FA Cup on Saturday and Champions League and Europa League coming up Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I'm excited.
Pumped, James. I can't wait.
Yeah.
I think the real great thing that's going to happen over the next few weeks is we're going to get a feel of what a European Super League looks like. where it's just the top teams in Europe playing every day, non-stop. This is what the future is going to be like.
Right, well, we better get on with getting our FA Cup final review out the way. Arsenal's 2-1 victory over Chelsea next.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson, part of The Athletic Podcast Network. And if you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, make sure you check out their coverage of each and every Premier League club by taking out a free 30-day trial by heading to theathletic.com/totally. Vamos!
Happy Gunners Saturday at Wembley. Arsenal rallying from a goal down to win their 14th FA Cup. For Arteta, it's a trophy in his first half season as manager. For Arsenal, it's a place in Europe next season. For Chelsea, major questions about refereeing and a very lengthy injury list. Should we start with the shameful scenes at the end as Aubameyang threw the world's most venerable trophy on the ground like it was a used NOS canister?
He dropped it like it's hot.
He certainly did. And they told him, don't pick it up with the base. But yeah, anyway, we can forgive him that because it was an exquisite goal which proved the winning strike in this final.
Yeah, sensational goal, particularly because judging by his post-match interview, it was something that he had in mind when he was going to go up against his former Saint-Étienne teammate, Kurt Zouma. Yeah, Zouma apparently knowing that Aubameyang, as most people do, likes to go on his right foot and just thinking, actually, I'm going to go on my left. But still, close control, the ability to shift it, lift it, outstanding, really, from, I would say, Arsenal's only out-and-out sort of world-class player at this moment in time, since the decline of Mesut Ozil, disappearance of Mesut Ozil. And again, just reinforces this idea that they need to hold on to players like that if they are to build, and this project that Arteta has is going to flourish, because at least the manager seemed optimistic yesterday that he will be able to keep him. But it's moments like that dare I say, in cliche terms, win football games, and Arsenal need guys like that.
All right, well, it literally did win this game, and Zouma's moment, unfortunately exposed relentlessly by BT Sport on social media, because they played out the goal with the original sound of Kurt Zouma's teammates calling out. Football 365 called this the most important result of Arsenal's recent history, and a large part of that, I imagine, is because of the impact it might have on Aubameyang's future. Rafa, if he was going, it is such a short transfer window, would we not have heard some whispers by now of his likely destination?
Yeah, I think you're right, James. I think there is a real problem for players who want to go to one of the two big Spanish teams because they don't seem to have the finances available. And for all the very well documented ambitions from Aubameyang to go to Spain. I haven't seen any credible indications that either Real Madrid or Barcelona are indeed willing or able to spend the kind of money that they'd need to get him, a player who is also, in terms of resale value, of course, not your most appealing target. Yes, instant hit rate, instant goals, but nothing to be really made 2-3 years down the line when perhaps you want to move on. Just a word on the recent history. I think, if anything, recent history has shown that FA Cups are not very important for Arsenal's travel because they haven't really told us much about where they're going. They've been very competitive in the FA Cup while continuously being less and less competitive where it really matters in the Premier League and in the Champions League. So I don't think Arteta needed that win necessarily to suggest that Arsenal are going to a better place. I think it's a bonus. It'll help with team morale. I think it'll help the team find that bit of togetherness. But I don't think people's opinions, very internally or externally, about Arteta would have changed much if he'd lost a game that they could have easily lost. I think if things have fallen slightly differently throughout the 90 minutes. Arsenal weren't the better side, I think, but they managed to weather the storm. And I'm interested in Michael's opinion on this, but in my view, Arteta also won by basically saying, you know what, we can do all this beautiful football another day. We're just going to sit back and do what we did very successfully in some of the bigger games and since the restart and just play on the break. And to hell with the philosophy and all the passing and all that stuff. We'll go long, we'll expose them, and it worked really well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it was as defensive as we saw Arsenal against City and Liverpool in those two victories. But yeah, I agree with you in terms of they were much more direct than usual. I mean, almost their only approach really was getting the ball to David Luiz or Kieran Tierney and chipping it into the channel in behind Azpilicueta before he went off injured for either Aubameyang or Ainsley Maitland-Niles, who's had a real rejuvenation in the last month or so, and I think was one of the key players here. I think it was also notable, really, that Frank Lampard struggled to adjust, because that really was Chelsea's only problem in this game in terms of where Arsenal were exposing them. And I was surprised that he didn't change things. I mean, if you think back to that Chelsea-Arsenal game or Arsenal-Chelsea game at the Emirates just after Christmas, Lampard completely changed that game by moving from a 3-4-3 to a four-man defence. And really, that was what changed the game. Arsenal were 1-0 up and Chelsea ended up winning 2-1. And it wasn't necessarily that he needed to change formation, but I couldn't really see any attempt to change the game from Lampard. I thought even just moving Reece James back 20 metres to give Azpilicueta and then Zuma some proper help against Aubameyang would have been the obvious move. But in the end, it just felt like Chelsea were giving, as James says, probably the only world-class player on the pitch, too much space. And that caused both goals, the first one for the penalty, which Aubameyang won and then scored, and then for the winner later on.
Was there another world-class player on the pitch, but who then went off having done his hamstring in the shape of Christian Pulisic? And was that one of the key moments?
Yeah, I mean, I think world-class will probably come when he's been doing it, so to speak, for a few more years. But yeah, it was, I think, a huge blow to Chelsea. I mean, he'd been so lively in the first 10 minutes in particular. And yeah, to go off, I think, 2 minutes into the second half was a big blow. And I also thought Azpilicueta going off was a blow, not just the fact that he went off, but the fact that Lampard maybe didn't elect to change things at that point. I thought that was a good opportunity maybe to bring on another central midfielder, but he went for like as he could with Christensen on. So yeah, in different ways, I think the injuries affected Chelsea.
Rafa, when you say that you don't think that Arsenal were necessarily the better side in this game, were Chelsea just unlucky?
No, it's not just about being unlucky. It's also about, from Arsenal's point of view, being very efficient, very clinical with your game plan. They had a game plan, as Michael said, that really worked. They managed to expose a Chelsea defence that had been struggling before, and we know that they have weaknesses. I think they also were quite smart by just inviting Chelsea forward. There were moments in the second half when it was still 1-1 where you had almost the entire Arsenal team camped around their box with just Aubameyang slightly sort of to the left being ready for the inevitable outlet that was going to come. And it worked really well. I think before that, especially in the first half, Chelsea probably were the better footballing side, if that makes sense. And I think with Pulisic, they lost the ability to move between the lines. The first goal, well, the only goal that Chelsea scored came all from Pulisic being available and then taking the ball beautifully on the turn and then running at the Chelsea defence, and total chaos ensued. And those kind of movements through the middle weren't as effective without him. And they showed all the issues that we've seen before. I think it reminded me a little bit of the game against Bayern Munich in the Champions League, where they played well at stages and they had nice possession and they had sort of good opportunities to create opportunities. But without possession, especially in transition, they are very slow to flip the switch and take a long time to have any sort of defensive shape. And for teams who can expose that on the flanks, especially with pace, it explains, I think, why Chelsea have struggled to keep clean sheets and have conceded quite as many goals, despite all the progress that I think we should also mention and the good work that Lampard has done. This is still a very unfinished team. But I think the same goes for Arsenal. If you look at their results and their performances, I think they've been pretty uneven, despite a marked improvement since lockdown. And not quite as dramatic an underdog victory, if you will, as a few years ago when they came up against Contes at Chelsea, but still a bit of a surprise and I think a welcome moment of happiness for Arsenal fans who haven't had too many of them in recent years.
And any Chelsea haters who might have been watching as well. Sorry, Michael.
Yeah, no, I really agree with what Rafa says about the defensive transitions. I think that the second goal was a really good example of that. About 15 seconds before Aubameyang dinked it in, Reece James was pressing Kieran Tierney about 10 yards from the corner flag at the other end of the pitch. And by the time Aubameyang had scored, he hadn't come back into the picture again from the television footage. It wasn't necessarily Reece James's fault. In fact, I don't think it was his fault at all. But the fact he was absolutely nowhere near in a position to give any sort of protection to the defence, I think kind of summed up why Chelsea have conceded so many goals this season.
Rafi, I mean, as someone who is appearing on this call with a Kai Havertz mask and a Chelsea shirt with Havertz 10 on the back, I know that they're obviously Pedro is moving on, Willian's expected to move on, they need to fill gaps in those positions in the team. But do you not think Chelsea could maybe, you know, having the 12th best defence in the Premier League this season, would not be better served spending Havertz-style money on a centre-back?
I completely agree. And that's why when Chelsea's interest for Havertz first kind of became, I don't want to say apparent, but we heard rumours about it back in March, I think, or April, it seemed incongruous because you felt that Chelsea had other more important positions to fill first. But I think there is obviously a sense that he is too good a player to miss out on in a market where Chelsea are one of the very few teams who can push these kind of buttons, these 100 million euros, give or take buttons. So he might not be what they need right now, but he's certainly going to be a superstar if they do get him eventually. So I can understand the attraction. But yeah, it's not just I think the personnel, though. I think it's more to do with the organization, with the collective approach. I mean, you look at Arsenal's back four and it doesn't necessarily strike you as the best in the Premier League either. But what Arteta has been able to do is get the whole team working a lot harder without the ball, making them a lot more compact and, you know, finding ways to mitigate these issues. And I think that Lampard being concentrated more on the possession side and more trying to make Chelsea into a pressing team, very aggressive, high up the pitch, similar to what Arteta's trying to do, but perhaps with less pragmatism and less patience, you might say, just needs to work a little bit harder on those issues. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a personnel decision, even though I would say that on the fullback positions or wingbacks, if you will, depending on the system, that Chelsea have been lacking a little bit recently and definitely need some strengthening, in my view.
Amongst other things hampering Lampard's team in this game, though, the sending off of Kovacic, which we should have a word on. It was a pretty strange decision by Anthony Taylor and not helped at all by the, play acting of Granit Xhaka, though, after the challenge.
I agree. I think Chelsea was slightly hard done by on a couple of incidents, actually. Albeit, I don't think it decided the game because I think Arsenal were the better side, but it did deny them the chance to get back into it in the final 20 minutes. The only thing I'd say is that I thought Chelsea were also quite indisciplined. I mean, they conceded 12 or 13 fouls, I think, to Arsenal's two. And, I mean, the more you do concede fouls, the more there is a chance of the referee being slightly harsh with the cards he shows. So, yeah, probably goes both ways.
I mean, I think you have to sympathise with Chelsea to a certain extent because they lose the two players we mentioned, Pulisic and Azpilicueta, who are important for different reasons, and Iluf Kovacic, who is maybe the one player that can provide a bit of glue between the attacking and the defending. And after that, you just didn't recover, and you just get the sense that the game is completely slipping away from them. So in finals between teams that are fairly evenly balanced, you have three bad breaks, effectively. It was just too much for Chelsea.
Right. Yeah, no, Pulisic and Azpilicueta then, as Chelsea prepare to face Bayern again at the end of this week. Starting to think that their chances might not be too good of going through in that particular tie. Arsenal, meanwhile, celebrating wildly there in the locker room post-game. They are in Europe, continuing that 25-year run in continental competition. Their victory also means that Spurs have to play three extra preliminary matches to get into the main body of the Europa League, so they'll be delighted about that. And a quick mention for the fact that it was a really successful week for David Luiz, who A, didn't give away a penalty, and B, did you see, also successfully sued the Brazilian construction firm who had run a campaign with the slogan "Don't hire amateurs to do a professional's job," and used a picture of him from Brazil's 7-1 defeat to Germany in the 2014 World Cup. And he took them to court for defamation and won. But he only got £4,500 damages, which suggests that, you know, his reputation actually wasn't worth much anyway. Still, nice to get a win. Well, next up at Wembley, it is, of course, the playoff final on Tuesday. Bees against Cottagers Tuesday night for an estimated £170 million prize and the chance to have an early run in the Premier League, upset a major side, be top six by Christmas, and then collapse dramatically into a grim battle for survival in the new year. One of Brentford and Fulham will receive that heady opportunity, but which? We'll be discussing that next.
Everyone remembers that time you've had that peach of an accumulator looking good only for, oh, and the keeper's let it slip through his legs in the 94th minute. Or the right back has to pull on the gloves and face a penalty. Or Man United have again conceded a late equaliser. But with Paddy Power's Acca Cracker, you get a free bet if one leg of your fourfold plus Acca lets you down on all football matches and all markets. Paddy Power. Max free bet £10. Minimum odds of 1 to 5 on each leg. Online exclusive. Excludes shop bets. T's and C's apply. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Listener, we're joined now by Billy Grant of the Be Sotted podcast. Hello, Billy.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you for joining us. Also with us, Drew Heatley from the Fulhamish podcast.
Hello, everyone.
Hello. Of course, you guys are going to be head-to-head on opposite sides of the big divide come Tuesday night with the promotion playoff at Wembley. Drew, the joy of winning this game, you had it in 2018. Is there anything like it in football in your experience?
Honestly, there's nothing like it. I mean, we were lucky enough to have the Europa League final a decade ago, but I mean, that missed the fairy tale ending the day out of Wembley last time with, you know, family and friends, some of whom aren't no longer with us. It was the best footballing day, the perfect day, and that's what makes this time round so strange. But behind closed doors, football is still football, and it means everything on Tuesday.
Mm. Billy, the flip side, of course, is a team that can go to the playoffs eight times and never succeed.
We played Stoke City at Cardiff in 2002. We were the first team to lose in the lucky dressing room. We played Crewe in 1997, and they finished sixth. We finished third, and then we fluffed that one as well. And also Yeovil in 2013, we lost that one as well. So we're not great at playoff finals. Eight played and eight lost so far. But it's interesting, you were talking about crowds and going down to Wembley. I mean, ironically, I've literally just come back and I was actually hooked up with the other two guys, Sammy and Jack from Fulhamish, and we actually had a drink on Wembley Way literally just now, and we were sitting down there. We did our co-podcast. I was on the Fulhamish podcast, they were on the Besotted Pride of West London podcast as well, and we were recording for a couple of hours, enjoying ourselves, talking football and just having a bit of a laugh and stuff. And all of a sudden we looked around, we thought, Actually, it's the conference playoff final between Harrogate and Notts County right behind us. And you would have had no idea it was going on. You had the buskers and tourists and people chatting. It was really, 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 really strange. So, I mean, I think I've got my little Wembley fix there from going down there today. In the back of my head, I'm thinking, listen, I've been to all eight of our playoff losses so far and it hasn't gone particularly well. So maybe on the flip side of it, actually me not being there might actually be a thumbs up for Brentford. They might actually do something this time.
What do you make of Brentford's form coming into this game? Because the Bees rather choked in the final two games of the season. But then the second leg with Swansea was one of your finest performances of the campaign.
I disagree to say that a team choked. I think all of a sudden, out of the blue, you know, we looked like we might get automatic promotion. When lockdown finished and we started our first game, which ironically again was against Fulham, we were 10 points away from West Brom. No one gave us a chance of doing anything but getting to the playoffs. So we won that game, we beat West Brom, and all of a sudden we'd won six matches. I was really relaxed coming out of lockdown because I didn't expect anything to happen. But then Swansea, you know, they had 12 men for that game, you know, 11 men and the referee, Keith Stroud. And he managed to give them the win for that game, but we managed to turn it around for the other game. And I just knew we were going to win that Swansea game because after the way that we had played, after the way that all the players are fired up, and I just thought, listen, we've got nothing to lose. Brentford are going to that game, nothing to lose. We'll come into that and we'll be absolutely fired up. And the football we played in that Swansea game, we torn to bits, basically. And I think coming into that Fulham game off the back of that Swansea game is the best position we could be in.
Drew, what concerns you most about Brentford on Tuesday?
That they've had our number this season. They've had our number a few times in the last sort of 5-6 years, more often than not. And look, they play fantastic football. But I think what concerns me the most is what I think is probably their greatest strength at the moment, could also be their greatest weakness, is this wave of emotion that they're riding on, similar to the way that we did under Slavica Jokanović a few seasons ago. You know, they obviously have that momentum bar the couple of losses at the end of the season, but we lost to Birmingham on the last day when we could have secured automatic. So it's very, very similar. And, you know, Billy says he knew that they were going to beat Swansea. Thomas Frank knew as well. And he, you know, he was very bolshy. And I think that could be the Achilles heel as well, this wave of emotion that Brentford are riding on. Whereas alternatively, if you look at if you look at Fulham this time round, you know, we're the wily veterans of the playoff four, and we certainly are in the wily veterans of these of the final out of Fulham and Brentford. We've been there, we've done that. I think 8 or 9 players in the squad for the last Championship playoff final are still in and around the first team squad now, so we've got that experience. And of course, Marek Rodak in goal won a playoff final at Wembley with Rotherham a couple of seasons ago as well. I think maybe even last season. So we have that experience, and I'm hoping that will be the difference maker come Tuesday.
Drew Heatley from Fulhamish Podcast and Billy Grant of Besotted. And as Billy was mentioning there, they've done a special joint. The two bitter rivals, Fulham Brentford, have come together to make a special joint podcast ahead of Tuesday's final. Drew was mentioning there Brentford's great record against Fulham. In fact, in the regular season, two meetings, the most recent being 20th of June at Craven Cottage, which was the first fixture back after lockdown, and Brentford won that 2-0. And Michael Cox, you were there.
I was, yeah. I think first weekend of football after the lockdown. So, yeah, it was a good game. Funny game where it kind of ebbed and flowed, and I think both sides had their period of dominance, but Brentford the better side on that occasion. They also won the previous meeting between the sides, as Drew mentioned, I think. And I'd have them as favourites. I think Brentford on their day just played brilliant football, and I think they're slightly more of a cohesive unit than Fulham, both with and without the ball. So I quite like both sides, and wouldn't mind either of them coming up, but I do think Brentford have probably got the edge.
James, you're rooting for Fulham, aren't you? Because great day out.
Yeah, for the basic reason I like being down the river there. I, you know, like the walk. I like the chants that opposition fans sing at Fulham fans. You know, you only drink white wine. That sort of works for me. I like the rickety wooden stands. Yeah, it's I hope they do what they did last time in the event that they come up to the Premier League, which is completely blow up what got them there and go on a ridiculous spending spree and sign silly players, and it'd be quite fun to watch. So
brilliant, Rafa. Whose colours will you be face painting with on Tuesday night?
I have a very soft spot for Brentford.
Why?
And I've even scored a goal at Griffin Park. Why? Because I used to work for Matthew Benham. the owner.
And when did you score your goal at Griffin Park? And also, what did you do for Matthew Benham?
So, you know, Matthew Benham, as you know, made his fortune with sports betting. And in the past, I was providing some information on the Bundesliga for him.
Nice. All right. When did you score your goal at Griffin Park?
Yeah, there was a we had like kind of a company day out, I guess, of people that work with him. And we're all allowed to play at Griffin Park. And I scored a beautiful goal. I didn't do much else, but the goal was great.
Describe it, Raf. What happened?
So the ball bounced just outside the box, like in the D, and I took it as it was just on its way down again, kind of getting over it with the outside of the boot, and just flew in top corner. It was just wonderful.
Well, we can only hope that we see similar spectacle this Tuesday between Brentford and Fulham. Next up, we've got to talk about some other big news from the weekend football.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Plenty of big stories in the world of football of late. Sunday afternoon saw Harrogate conquer a place in the Football League for the first time in over 100 years of history with a 3-1 win over Notts County at Wembley. Elsewhere in Yorkshire football news, bad tidings for Sheffield Wednesday, who've been handed a 12-point penalty for next season. This is over this business of them selling the stadium to themselves and then including the figures in their accounts. And as I understand it, they're not the only club that's facing charges over this. Derby County are certainly as well, and one or two other clubs might be. But as I understand it, the big difference with Sheffield Wednesday was that they sold their ground to another company that the chairman owned. But then they entered the money that they'd received in the previous year's accounts, which does sound a little bit creative. Anyway, 12 points for next season. Crikey. Meanwhile, down in Bournemouth, club reeling post-relegation from the news that Eddie Howe has decided, in conjunction with the club, that it's time for him to move on. The man who'd taken them from the brink of non-league football to the top flight in five mostly glorious seasons there. Listeners writing in, Alex Cooney: with Eddie Howe gone, the second smallest stadium even in the Championship, and going from approximately 90% of EPL money on wages to parachute money, are Bournemouth in real trouble of being the next Leeds or Sunderland and dropping down again. Steve Malanga, meanwhile, asking how long has it been since a club with a smaller ground as Bournemouth stayed up in the First Division for as long as Eddie Howe's team did. Well, yeah, there's the question of danger, and there's also the view that we have these days of Eddie Howe, which I think maybe has been coloured a little bit by the deeply disappointing season that the Cherries had, but it was an extraordinary tenure that he had there.
I think Eddie Howe and Bournemouth are victims of their own success to a certain extent. You kind of get used to the fact that they're there. They were always in mid-table sometimes, looking as if they could do a little bit better, but then ultimately sort of just being safe. And every year you just think, okay, Bournemouth are Bournemouth and they're going to be okay. And now I think it's seen as a disaster, whereby actually, if you look at the size of the club, if you look at the possibilities, the tradition, all the metrics, KPIs that you can think of, it's perhaps not a surprise that a team like Bournemouth do go down. And I think the problem that Eddie Howe has is that people remember now that he's the guy that got Bournemouth relegated, rather the guy that managed to establish Bournemouth, I don't want to say against all the odds, but certainly with a very weak hand, for such a long time. The other thing I think, which is maybe an issue, I mean, some people have compared him to Jurgen Klopp in the sense that maybe he can come back from being relegated, having taken a very unfashionable club up and kept them up for at least a bit. Some people have made the argument, you know, he can sort of emulate Klopp and now get a better job on the back of that. I think the only problem there is that he just doesn't come across as a very charismatic figure. I think bigger clubs don't just want the football acumen, they also want a face, somebody that will represent the club, somebody that will sell the club to the public, to future or prospective players that are going to come in. And you just don't get that with Eddie Howe. He's just so straight-laced and just batting. I don't know if any idea about cricket. I don't know what you say, straight batting, I think. Just so kind of matter-of-fact. That is the correct expression, no? That I think that makes him less saleable, you know, as an asset. And I think that's the issue for him.
Of course, part of the dismantling of Bournemouth has already got underway with the £41 million move for Nathan Aki from Manchester City. Some people have expressed surprise at that valuation. Other people say it's a great deal. Michael, where do you stand on this?
Somewhere in between. I think he's a good player. He's not going to transform their defence. I'm not sure he'll necessarily be even a first choice. There's some question about Laporte and him both being left-footed. And OK, you can say you wouldn't have an issue with two right-footed players playing together at the back. But I think usually with right-footed players, one of them has some experience playing to the left because they are rare, so they have to slot in. So there's a slight issue with that. I think it's probably a worthwhile deal. But like I say, I mean, I'm not sure that it's going to be a transformative signing. I think he'll slot in and probably do a decent job there.
Well, as listeners were mentioning, there are difficult times ahead for the club in their attempts to reclaim a place in the top tier. Still could be worse. There could be Newcastle, whose long-suffering fans were greeted Thursday with the news that the much-discussed takeover bid by Amanda Staveley's group was off again after the Saudis had withdrawn their interest. 5 months of takeover talk on Tyneside going up in smoke. For us, this means war. Chris Waugh, that is, who is the Athletic's Newcastle correspondent and, of course, a voice of Pod on the Tyne podcast, and joins us now. Chris, thank you so much for joining us. Amanda Staveley herself makes the suggestion that the Premier League was almost deliberately stalling to kind of bury the whole thing and not have to make a decision and kind of force the Saudi investors to walk away.
Well, yeah, she's made some quite strong allegations in an article. My colleague George Colkin interviewed her and her husband Mehrdad Gadousi, and yeah, the consortium feel that the Premier League kept on. They talk about them shifting the goalposts repeatedly and just not even willing to give it a time frame on when they may have given an answer on when potentially that they would have come back and said that yes, either we will pass it or we will reject this. And it had been 16 weeks, but all parties have been told to begin with this process usually takes around 4 weeks. Obviously, this has become far more complicated. You've had the issues of piracy, human rights, everything which has been well documented. But the Premier League, in my personal view, and I think a lot of people certainly in the Northeast media and in general feel that the Premier League should come out and at least explain what has happened over the last 16 weeks. Look, there's a lot of stuff which I'm sure is confidential, and they might not be able to go into the specifics of some parts of it. But one of their 20 member clubs and the fans of one of their 20 member clubs, who often get forgotten about, they're almost a disenfranchised sort of support. They are the most important part of football, yet they get so little actual ability to influence what goes on, and they just want an explanation as to why this has happened over the last 16 weeks, why they've been left with an owner who himself admits he wants to be out, who for once seems to have actually been someone who was trying to facilitate this sale as well. And yet Newcastle fans don't know why it dragged on so long. They've heard from the prospective buyers, they've made allegations, the Premier League have refused to comment, and I just think that what everyone wants is just some sort of closure on this. Is this the end? Is this never going to happen? Or is it, why is this not being possible to happen? Why have these prospective owners not been able to take over Newcastle United? And really, just as is so often the case with, unfortunately, with this club, we're just left with so many more questions than we are answers.
The club, as you mentioned, has been through this so many times before, Chris. Is this time worse, though, than before?
Yeah, this time does feel worse than before. I think for many reasons. I think that given that it's now 13 years or more than 13 years that Mike Ashley's been there, just the length of time, it's all kept adding up, and you have so many fans who feel apathetic. A lot of fans are starting to give up season tickets. Newcastle United had to give away 10,000 free half-season tickets in December because a club which is famous for turning up regardless, actually fans were stopping turning up, and there's been so many sort of shadow takeover, false takeover, however we want to look at it, where they haven't actually come to fruition. Whereas this time, it seems that Mike Ashley himself wasn't the problem. We've had allegations in the past, including from Amanda Staveley herself, the first time she tried to buy the club in November 2017, that he has been a difficult person to try and negotiate with. I've heard that from other prospective buyers as well. But this time, he himself has actually come out and said, no, I still want to sell. I am committed to selling. Amanda Staveley herself has even said this time that he wasn't the problem. problem, even though there was the chance that he tried to renegotiate the price. And so Newcastle fans have been through this for 16 weeks. The club has been in limbo in terms of the transfer window. How can they approach this? What was the budget going to be? Steve Bruce, the head coach, was in an almost impossible position. And I think that really the issue for Newcastle fans now, and the reason they do feel so deflated, is it's that inability to see now, where is the end for Mike Ashley? How does he leave as owner? Because we're in the middle of a global pandemic. It was bizarre in itself that the club could potentially have been taken over in a £305 million deal during the middle of what is a financial crisis around the world. And it's who is going to come in and pay that sort of money to Mike Ashley in this situation. And so it's that loss of hope, I think, that really has affected Newcastle fans. And they're fallen out of love with the club. They want someone to come in and give them that ability to be able to believe in them again. And at the minute, I just think with everything that's going on, it's very difficult to see that far into the future.
All right. I think a lot of people maybe outside the club, some have even welcomed this news because of the problems with the Saudi money. Is there any way that those closer to home might feel that in the long run this could even turn out better?
Yeah, I mean, look, the Newcastle United Supporters Trust early on in this did a survey with supporters, and I think it was close to 97% said they would be in favour of this consortium coming in. But I don't think that is necessarily reflective of how everyone has felt throughout this. A lot of Newcastle fans have been extremely conflicted. Some have been against it. I wouldn't say that's a majority by any stretch, but there have been a lot who feel conflicted. I, as a reporter who covers the club, has felt conflicted about this, given the atrocities of the Saudi regime and all the piracy and everything that comes with it, primarily the human rights. And yes, I can see that argument that maybe in the long term, would you want your club to be 80% owned by someone who's closely linked to the Saudi regime? I just think that there's a bit more nuance to this, just from a purely footballing point of view from Newcastle United fans. I think a lot of the excitement was about the fact that Mike Ashley was potentially going to be going rather than necessarily who was going to be replacing him. And I can see why people would say, well, you can't separate the two. And yeah, I understand that. But just having been in the Tyneside bubble for the last 13 years, the frustration there is with Mike Ashley, the longing for him to go, I think that is part of the issue here. Maybe we look back on this in a few years' time if the club is taken over by someone else and say it was a lucky escape. I just think it at this very moment in time, with it still raw and still unable to see beyond Mike Ashley, I just think it's difficult to view it in such a way at this very moment in time.
You can hear more from Chris Waugh on the Pod on the Tyne podcast, and they've certainly got lots to talk about at the moment. Very difficult times. I do appreciate, I don't know what your feelings are on this, the frustration of Newcastle fans, but I'm not sure if I would necessarily single out the Premier League as being the responsible one for it. I'm quite confused about why Amanda Staveley thought that pitching up with a consortium essentially funded by pirate money was going to be all plain sailing.
Well, I suppose...
Pirate money.
Pirate money.
Shiver me timbers.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
I suppose she looked at other takeovers, not just in the Premier League, that have been successful with sovereign wealth money.
Yeah, right. But I mean, the question here being that sovereign wealth money is tied in with a regime that's pretty much made, I wouldn't say an act of war, but they've certainly been in direct kind of conflict legally, economically, in all sorts of ways, ethically even, with one of the Premier League's biggest rights holders, beIN Sports.
That's true, James, but that money also comes from lots of other areas which I think have attracted fair scrutiny over the course of this takeover. So, I think, quite rightly, from an ethical and moral standpoint, there were questions as to whether the Premier League should be welcoming that kind of investment. I sympathise with Newcastle fans. They clearly want a change of ownership. They clearly want to see the club. But also, I think the city, and I think that's probably key as well in this, because you look at, say, what Manchester City's owners have done for that, for the area around the Etihad, for that part of Manchester, completely helped with its regeneration. There's an element of that in wanting to see that for Newcastle and for, I think that's a general feeling across the north. But does that make it okay to have PIF as the people who are putting the money in?
The be out issue was the Achilles heel of the bid, and I think they perhaps underestimated the people trying to buy the club. how sensitive the Premier League would be about this and how the bottom line and the way it would affect the other clubs would be a huge consideration. Perhaps there was a view that another huge wealthy club being created would be overwhelmingly good for business, so that we could ignore these other factors. But I think once Bein and the Qataris sort of started alerting clubs to the problem, it became very difficult, I think, for the Premier League to wave this through and to basically bite the hand that feeds it to a certain extent in this area.
Yeah, essentially indulge somebody who's been pirating the material of one of the Premier League's biggest yeah. partners.
Non-original equally. Pirate material.
Yeah, very nice. And the fact that there has been such a delay in this, I think, and now there's this decision, I think it's partly due to the fact that there was this World Trade Organization verdict which came down against the Saudis, and people felt, well, this will be the moment that they'll take to distance themselves from Be Out Q, their pirate operation, and instead they took the opposite approach, and that's why, effectively, I think there was no way it could have gone through. But yes, a deeply frustrating time for Newcastle supporters, and let's hope that there is something better around the corner for us, listener, something very special indeed, because it's time to look ahead to the very exciting season finale that awaits us over the next few weeks.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on the Athletic app, this is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Starting this Wednesday, it's happening. The Champions League and the Europa League will be picking up where they left off before lockdown. We've got the remaining last 16 matches, the ones that didn't get played back in March. Then, from Monday the 10th, 8 teams in Lisbon for a special Champions League mini-tournament, quarter-final, semis and final, straight knockout competition. And 8 teams heading to Germany for the Europa League equivalent. Listen, excitingly, we're going to be doing nightly shows here at Totally, just like a regular summer cup competition, so you can get the latest news every morning, plus a look ahead to what the evening holds. For now, with Rafa, Michael and James, let's have a quick word about what this week's games hold and what are the big questions ahead of the final 8 tournaments. What are you looking out for most this week, James?
Well, for me, I think it has to be that Lyon-Juventus game because I think a lot's riding on it. There are still doubts about the future of Maurizio Sarri at Juventus. And, you know, whilst they go into that game match fit, unlike Lyon, who, you know, they played the Coupe de la Ligue final and lost on penalties at the weekend, they still look a bit rusty. And I think all the pressure is ultimately on Juventus. A team that is behind the goal in this tie. They've shown themselves unable to really defend convincingly so far this season. So the chances of Lyon, for example, getting an away goal, which would make it even more difficult for Juventus to overcome them and get into the quarterfinals. Yeah, it's an interesting prospect, really, because, you know, as with so many of the top sides in Europe's top 5 leagues, you know, in Germany, in France, and in Italy, ultimately seasons are decided by what the champions do in the Champions League. And I think, you know, whilst the club is kind of putting out a very united front that don't underestimate how hard it is to win a league title. It was very interesting on when was it, Friday, that Juventus unveiled Andrea Pirlo as their new under-23 manager. And they had Andrea Agnelli, the president, beside him. They had Fabio Paratici, the chief football officer, beside him. Federico Cherubini, the kind of supervisor of the under-23s there. They had the head of comms there. And then when Maurizio Sarri spoke, an hour or so later, he was, you know, he wasn't there on his own, but there wasn't the same presence there. And Agnelli, in his short address, you know, thanked the guys next to him, thanked the nutritionists, the kit men. But it was remarked on that he didn't seem to thank Maurizio Sarri for winning the league title. Maybe that's because he thought he didn't need to, because it had already been done. But it did feel quite telling that he didn't. So I think this is going to be very interesting. I think if he wins the tie and gets through, you know, you can pretty much look at who they're going to get in the next round, which will be one of City and Real Madrid, and say, yeah, that's difficult for whoever you are. But if you go out against Lyon, you know, that is going to raise more questions on a mounting list of questions that have been written up over the course of this season for Sarri.
All right, for a Juventus team that, as it turned out, only won the Italian title by 1 point over Inter. Remarkable.
Yeah, closest title race since 2002, James. You know, those people who keep calling it a farmers' league. Well, I mean, to say they only won it by 1 point and it was very close, I mean, maybe overlooks the fact that it never really felt very close. But still, certainly felt Vincent.
But I thought that Christian Eriksen would be the missing piece for Inter when they bought him.
Yeah, well, Raf, that has been, I wouldn't say a disaster so far, but certainly reservations around where he would fit in to the tactical plan of a coach who predominantly has made his name playing 3-5-2, you know, throughout his career. I think those reservations have been justified, and Eriksen has hardly played since the restart in the league. He did play well in the Cup semi-final, which, you know, they ultimately lost to Napoli, and then their first game back, I think, against Sampdoria, but has been peripheral since then. And Conte is kind of, I mean, I was just watching some of the pre-match build-up to today's games on Sunday as we record, and the sense that Eriksen's been kind of humiliated by being kind of brought on in the 89th minute, the 88th minute, which is not something you necessarily do with a player who arrived as a star in January. Conte's got other problems at the moment. He went on one of his big rants yesterday. But so, I mean, that's another game I'll be looking out for, the Getafe game.
The Europa League.
Given Getafe have won two of their last 15 games, if Inter were to lose that, that would not be good either.
Right. Conte telling his directors who financed the remarkable spending spree that he went on, don't try and celebrate with me. Don't climb on this bandwagon. There's been no support. I'm not happy at all.
Yeah, and the key quote, James, me and the players have taken shovel loads of over the last season, which was pretty strong. I would also say that he did clarify he wasn't aiming those comments at the recruitment team. And I think there is a sense that they were aimed at the comms team at Inter, in that too many leaks keep getting out and it makes his job difficult. And a top club like Inter shouldn't be having to put out fires like whatever Marcelo Brozovic has done this week. So, yeah, tension there.
Will he be any happier when they buy him Leo Messi, do you think?
Yeah, that has been a tormentone, as they say in Italy. It's been a rattling on in the background ever since the Chinese rights holders of Serie A, who happen to be owned by Suning, who are the company that controls Inter, basically projected an image of Lionel Messi onto the Duomo, which, you know, reading the tea leaves, of course, means that Inter are going to sign Lionel Messi, whose father has just bought some real estate in Milan, close to Inter's offices. Apparently relocating business interests there for tax purposes, given that the Messi family do have an Italian passport. So, you know, all roads lead to Milan, James. So, you know, expect, you know, we've been talking about Lautaro Martinez maybe going to Barcelona to play with Messi. It's clearly a straight swap. It's clearly a straight swap that's going on there.
Stranger things have happened. Cristiano Ronaldo going to Juventus for one. So keep an eye on that over the summer transfer window. But anyway, we were discussing the Europa League and Champions League. Fixtures get underway on Wednesday. You've got the Europa League ones Wednesday and Thursday. Man United on Wednesday taking on Lens. They're 5-0 up. They could be facing Wolves, actually, in the semi-final if they both get through. Wolves, though, are currently 1-1 against the Greek side Olympiakos. Well, Michael, what's caught your eye? What have you ringed in red for your viewing pleasure this week?
Looking forward to actually the other game on Friday night. I think Manchester City Real Madrid is very much still alive. City were impressive in winning away at the Bernabeu 2-1, but I still don't trust Pep Guardiola's defence in a Champions League situation. I think City will do well to keep clean sheets for the rest of the Champions League campaign, so I wouldn't rule Real out of that one. And Barcelona and Napoli as well, all square. You know, big question marks about Barcelona and whether they've got the you know, basically just the quality to get through into the semi-finals or the quarterfinals and then the semi-finals, as you'd expect, really. But I must say, I mean, looking further forward, I'm just quite excited by the one-leg nature of the quarterfinals and semi-finals. It's obviously something completely new for the Champions League. I think it will bring a slightly different dynamic. I hope that teams don't react to that and play too defensively. I hope they, you know, Atalanta against PSG, I think, is a game where all of us, aside from Jules, would like to see Atalanta go all guns blazing and and really, you know, demonstrate the idea that for a one-leg game, maybe it does favour the underdog. But yeah, I just think that'll be really interesting. And I'm just quite excited by this almost condensed format. Just gives a kind of freshness to the Champions League that maybe in recent years you kind of think it's the same teams and the same kind of games. I think this will be something completely different.
I mean, it was said slightly tongue-in-cheek earlier about this being a prelude to what a European Super League might look like. But yeah, the idea of having back-to-back games and particularly games on weekends in the Champions League, you know, you look at Saturday, for example, Barcelona, Napoli, Bayern Munich, Chelsea. I mean, that very much whets the appetite. I think, yeah, some of the executives who've entertained not a European Super League, because that's not what they're trying to do, but reformatting the existing competition ahead of the next, when the rights are up in, 2024. I think they'll be watching how this is received and how it works very, very keenly.
Yeah, weekends very much on UEFA's agenda, I think, especially when it comes to the latter stages. But of course, one-legged games, not on UEFA's agenda, because they want more rather than fewer games of the big teams playing each other. But like Michael, I'm really looking forward to Manchester City, Real Madrid. I think the fact that there is no home advantage makes this much more open. The same is true of Barcelona, Napoli, and even Juventus against Lyon. I think all games where you would look at the traditional favourites, but perhaps have to mark them down to a certain extent because of the way the second leg works. Bayern, Chelsea, a game that I'll be lucky to go to, actually, I think will be less dramatic than some of the other fixtures because of Bayern's 3-0 lead, but still interesting because you wonder what kind of attitude Chelsea will go into this game with after the defeat in the FA Cup. They have lots of injuries that we talked about. Willian also not there. Kante might not be able to play. And it's a thankless task, I think, to go to Bayern. But Bayern, with some issues of their own, they have to replace Benjamin Pavard, who's made the right-back spot his own. He might not feature again at all in Champions League after hurting his ankle in a warm-up game. And the early indications from a game they played against Marseille a couple of days ago was that Joshua Kimmich will reprise his role as right-back, moving across from his defensive midfield position with Thiago coming back in as a partner for Leon Goretzka. So still pretty impressive Bayern team, but we'll have to see if they can make it work over the course of the next few games once they overcome Chelsea, of course.
It does sound like a terrific two and a bit weeks of competition, and it all starts on Wednesday. We'll touch a little bit on Wednesday's fixtures and look at a few more of your tweets in a moment or two. But first, here's Lee Price talking to producer Ben.
Thank you very much, listeners. All together now. Hello, Lee Price from Paddy Power. My, we've missed you. Lee, let's start, please, with the playoff final, the most lucrative match in football, TM. Who is going to come out on top and join West Brom and Leeds in the Premier League next season?
Crikey, really hard to tell after both teams went through two very different legs to get to the final. We make Brentford the favourites, but they're not odds on, which is indicative of how close this is. Brentford are evens to win this game, Fulham 13-5, and extra time, which every neutral secretly wishes for, is 11-5.
Okay, we're getting very excited about our daily Euro podcast that will be starting later on this week. Let's start with the, in no way minor prize, who is going to come out on top and win the Europa League this season?
Not a lot of change in this one, actually. So maybe I'll start with the outsiders. Rangers are 500-1. You can get Frankfurt at 175-1 or Copenhagen at 80-1. As for the top of the betting, well, you know how that looks. Man United are the favourites, 15-8, ahead of Inter, Leverkusen, Wolves and Sevilla.
And finally, Lee, the big one. We don't know the final lineup yet, but as things stand, who is going to win the Champions League?
Well, the big news flash here is that Man City are no longer the outright favourites. Okay, they're now the joint favourites instead. They and Bayern Munich are both 3-1. Our partners likened Bayern, despite their lack of games over the last few weeks. PSG are 5-1. Atalanta are 17-2, four favourites as it stands. Barcelona 9-1, same price as Atletico. You're looking for an English club beyond City. Chelsea are 250-1 and may no longer be in the conversation much longer.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Ooh, Scottish football's back on, everybody. Got back underway this weekend. The Totally Scottish Football Show is also back on. Ready to round up all the action and news you need to know with Andrew Slaven. So get on that. As I say, we're starting Wednesday night our special nightly roundups. Wednesday's fixtures that we'll be reacting to include the brand new Turkish champions, hey, Basaksehir here. They will be at Copenhagen, nursing a 1-0 lead from the first leg. Wolfsburg will be looking to come back from 2-1 down against Shakhtar Donetsk. And Man United will be in action against LASK, Austrian side from Linz. They're 5-0 up. What's the big story there, do you think, Rafa?
I think the big story is Wout Weghorst being so important for Wolfsburg. He is the man who's scored all the goals. He's the man who's, in a normal market, would be attracting a lot of demand, especially from sort of mid-sized clubs and clubs who want to perhaps target the Europa League places in big leagues. A real chance, I think, for the club and for him to make the most of what is going to be a pretty big spotlight. I think the fact that there will be games on after the last 16 that you'll have a whole evening to yourself effectively as a team that otherwise wouldn't command the same attention is a huge boon. And Wolfsburg, I think, have an outside chance of, if not winning this competition, at least sort of going into the semi-final and maybe final, because they are pretty solid and they score goals and they're a team that I think going to make it difficult. But they, of course, have to overcome Shakhtar after that 2-1 deficit.
Wolfsburg, who let Victor Osimhen go to Charleroi for little or no money, who's just moved to Napoli for 81.5 million. And the sell-on clause, well, I think was it 5 or 10%, the money going to Charleroi. So I'd say Wolfsburg have had a bit of a nightmare there.
Yeah, and a shame that Osimhen can't actually feature in Napoli's end of season this time around, particularly with Insigne potentially being out of the Barcelona tie, James.
Yeah, he pulled up injured in Saturday night's win at the San Paolo. And he didn't look good at all, sort of grimacing, sort of hobbling off the pitch. So I think it's going to be a big doubt. Although Dries Mertens can play on the left-hand side, they can play Arkadiusz Milik through the middle with Cajon on the right or whoever they want to go with. So they've got a lot of versatility up front. But Insigne, it is a blow, James, because he's been reborn really since Gattuso took over. Gattuso's made him more of a focal point than he was under Ancelotti, where he'd kind of lost his way. Remember in the group stages he was being left in the stands for games against, you know, one of those Belgian teams. I can't remember whether it's Brugge or Genk or Ghent even. It could be any one of them. Feels like such a long time ago now. But yeah, no, that is a blow, even though Mighty Dries, Ciro Mertens can probably do the business at the Camp Nou.
Rafa, you were talking about Wout Weghorst's prospects of earning himself a fat transfer. Danny Daly asking, what's your take on the Sancho situation and who has the better poker hand, Dortmund or Man United?
I'm not sure it's a case of who's got the better poker hand, because the price is clear. It's a question of whether Man United want to pay it or not. So far, the indications are that they feel they can perhaps get a better deal if they drag this out away. Dortmund are adamant that this is the price, 120 million euros, and it has to be done by the 10th of August. It's, I think, going to be difficult to climb down from that after having made, you know, both these demands financially and in terms of the timing of the potential deal so public and tying themselves to it. So if United think they can still make it happen without paying the price and without meeting Dortmund's deadline, that they can try. But I think Dortmund have made it quite obvious what they feel needs to be done for the deal to go through. And I think it's the way they see it, the ball is in United's court to see if they want to make it happen or not. They've been very clear. Right. So,
what do you think is going to happen, Rafa?
I think if United, for whatever reason, cannot or do not want to spend that kind of money this summer, thinking that next summer is going to be a more normal market, and of course his valuation will go down, having only 1 year left on his contract, then that could still be the outcome. But there's every chance that they will try again, if not now, then maybe in September or even in early October, with the window being open, and perhaps whereby we're all in a position where we know exactly, or have a better view, shall I say, about where things are going in terms of crowds being let in. At the moment, everyone's trying to work out how big the financial hit is that they're taking. And I think for clubs like Man United, it's very difficult to pull off a transfer of this magnitude, even for them. So they might just disregard Dortmund's valuation and their deadline and say, we're just going to keep trying, thinking that we have a good chance. But Dortmund could do the same. And I think, if you ask me personally, I think there is a deal to be done, and I think eventually it will go through, but eventually could also mean in January or maybe only in next summer.
Michael, are you a big fan of José María Callejón?
I quite liked him 2 or 3 years ago, yeah, why? Okay.
No, just because he's probably played his last game for Napoli. I know that you are quite partial to a bit of Serie A, and I got quite emotional over that because he's been one of my favourite Napoli players, and it's a shame that he's probably moving on now. Is that right, James, from the San Paolo? Napoli with a 3-1 win over Lazio there on Saturday night, which featured Ciro Mobile equaling Gonzalo Higuain's 36 goals in a season, a record. Yeah, established at the San Paolo itself.
Taking the golden boot from Robert Lewandowski as well.
Oh, yeah, that's
first
true.
First Italian to win it since Totti in 2006-07. It's the highest ever individual total that a Italian player has racked up in Serie A as well. And he perhaps would have broken that record had he not been so generous in giving away some of the many penalties he's got this season, because he scored, I think, was it 13 or 14? I think he gave one to Luis Alberto early in the season. I think he's given one to Caicedo. If he hadn't done that and he had scored them, he would have been alone in history. But remains a great achievement from Immobile, even though he still has his skeptics out there, I'd say more on social media than in reality, who seem to remember his Dortmund and Sevilla days over what he's done in Serie A, which won the Capocannoniere crown 3 times, James, which again puts him in very exclusive company.
All right. And Callejon, is he moving on?
Yeah, I think this is the feeling is that he is at this moment in time. I think he's had offers to go back to Spain, offers from MLS as well. I know that Dries Mertens has been doing his best to try and persuade the club to extend his contract, but it looks like Napoli are moving on. They've already got other players, younger players in his position, but very much part of what the best front three Napoli have had since Maradona, Giordano and Careca, the Magica trio with Mertens, Insigne and Callejon. Wonderful trio to watch, particularly under Sarri.
And also on the transfer front, and touching on Lazio, the team beaten by Napoli Saturday night, are they signing David Silva?
Well, they're having a go. I think it'll be very difficult for them to persuade Silva to join the club. I think Silva's intentions are to go back to Spain. But, you know, I think it shows the kind of ambition that that Lazio have. Yeah, in terms of star power, the league has gone old, you know, in terms of let's bring Ronaldo here, let's bring Ribéry here, let's bring Ibrahimovic here, now Silva, in the event that they were able to do that. But I don't think they will. I think ultimately Silva's, yeah, his intention to, well, in leaving City, it will be to go home, I think.
All right. Just Messi for next summer then. Okay.
No, just Messi.
Yeah. And now, meantime, one other story we're getting asked about a lot by listeners is the business with poor Josip Iličić, who's not been featuring or didn't feature for Atalanta for the end of this season, has returned to Slovenia for personal reasons. All sorts of wild stories flying around about him. It's certainly true that he doesn't seem to be in a particularly good place right now and is, I believe, extremely unlikely to feature in Atalanta's Champions League clash with PSG, James.
Yeah, he won't. The season's finished for Josip Iličić. He's on compassionate leave in Slovenia at the moment. Atalanta have given him their kind of full support. There are a lot of rumours around on social media in particular, and a lot of people wanting to know whether they're true. I think that's just respect the privacy of the player. From my experience of Josip Iličić, he is quite a sensitive individual. He was very moved and upset when his teammate Davide Astori passed away. He feared for his life when it was at the beginning of last season when he had a kind of bacterial infection in his neck and ended up going to hospital. And having seen what happened to Astori, didn't know what was going to happen there. And I think living in Bergamo throughout this period has been trying for him as well. And the club are sensitive to that. So wish him all the best. Because for me, he's been the best player in Serie A this season, without doubt. In fact, I was writing an interview for The Athletic this week with Ismail Benacer, and I ended up watching back some of the highlights from Atalanta's 5-0 win against AC Milan in December. And just what a player. I mean, not many people can do what Iličić can do. It's a shame he won't be there against PSG, but, first and foremost, his personal well-being. And, we send our wishes to him, James.
Certainly do. Of course, it was he who put Atalanta into the last eight with that extraordinary four-goal haul in the last 16 against Valencia. Remarkable stuff. Well, best wishes to him and of course, to Atalanta in that massive game with PSG. One of the many delights coming up in the return of the European Cups. We'll be back, as I say, on Wednesday night, reviewing the three games played then and looking forward to Thursday's action and beyond. Do join us for that. Should be with you Thursday morning. For now, though, it's many, many thanks to Raphael Honigstein, to Michael Cox, James Horncastle, producer Charlie, and you, listener. Have yourselves a great time until we're with you again. For now, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Keep up to date with everything across our Totally Football network at The Totally Show on Twitter. And make sure you check out our brand new website too, thetotallyfootballshow.com.
Muddy Knees Media.